Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
This episode is brought to you by PwC. When unprecedented times are all the time, it's time to start walking the talk. Leaders like you turn to PwC to see and stay ahead. Upskill your workforce, use intelligent automation, and transform big ideas into breakthrough reinvention. Explore the human-led, tech-powered solutions that help you reinvent. It's all part of the new equation. Learn more at pwc.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
The Cricket Podcast.
I think it should never be permitted to happen again.
That is very good.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Cricket Podcast with me, Jack Hope, and Ross Legg.
Hello.
This week on the show, we have a special episode. We are speaking to Chris Tremlett. Ross, we've just recorded the interview. What did you think?
What a lovely guy is the first one. And then, I mean, I didn't know, if I'm perfectly honest, how much he was actually involved across like the different Ashes series. And what I found amazing was that he was 12th man in the 2005 Ashes, which people might not really be aware of, went through, beat the Australians down under, and then was on the receiving end of being thrashed and the all fallout from the 2013-14 series. So actually, his experience across that kind of 10, 11 years was incredible, really. It was really great to talk to.
Yeah, I think he's really interesting and really honest as well. I don't think you'll hear another England player talk about those experiences as candidly as he did.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Which was excellent. What else do we need to mention before we play the interview?
That if you're listening to this, please subscribe and tell a friend. What we're trying to do here is build up our listener base so we can get quality guests on and actually improve the quality of the content that we're creating. So tell a friend, pass it on, subscribe, and find us on Twitter or Instagram at The Cricket Pod.
Great. We'll play a quick jingle, a slightly puerile jingle, but a very funny one. and then we'll be speaking with Chris Tremlett.
Ujar, 6 for 9 at Cockermouth. That's Ben Stokes' old club, isn't it?
Ujar. 6 for 9 at Cockermouth.
6 for 9 at Ujar Cup Cricket Club. Today we are joined by one of the few English players to have won an Ashes series down under. In his career, he took 50 wickets at just 27. But we're going to start with a question all of our listeners want the answer to. Chris Tremlett, what do you bench these days?
Yeah. I think my PB is about 170, so I'm trying to get that up towards the 200 mark. So yeah, about 170 at the moment, and just trying to build it every year and just trying to get a bit bigger and a bit stronger all the time. But yeah, certainly a bit better than it was when I was playing cricket.
Yeah, well, I think 170 is 2.5 of the Cricket Podcast. If you add us up, so it's not a bad effort, is it at all?
I've now got a picture of us side by side and Chris just holding us up.
Yeah, we'll have to get you down the gym and I'll just something like that.
Chris, yeah, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on. Right. We put out a tweet today letting people know you were coming on, and we'll start one of those questions if you don't mind. Robin Rounder asks, what was your favourite on-field memory from your cricketing days?
I mean, there's a few. I think the one that stands out probably the most is probably making my England debut. I think just receiving my cap at Lord's, it was kind of an unexpected kind of call up at the time. I think that's kind of your dream. That's what you dream of when you're a kid and you want to aspire to play for England. So when that moment actually happened, when Michael Vaughan gave my cap, that was pretty cool and pretty surreal. And I think in terms of actual playing memories, for me, it's hard to beat the Ashes in 2010-11. It's probably what people notice me more the most, I guess, is just that I played a bit in that series and won that series down under, and yeah, I played a part. So yeah, for me, that was probably like playing wise the most satisfying kind of moment in my career, and having a lot of injuries, being in and out of the England side over about a 10-year period, to have that success and do well over in Australia, with Australian fans who aren't the kindest at times, was a pretty satisfying moment. Also, again, very surreal moment. Have to kind of pinch myself sometimes when I look at pictures on the wall that I've got here at home. That was a really cool trip to be involved in, and it all kind of went our way, and we won a lot of games. And but I went back there in 2013 and lost 5-0. So I know what it's like to be on the other end of the to be on the other end of it. So to win in 2010-11 was certainly very special. It made all the injury and pain throughout my career worthwhile.
Yeah, I think as sort of fans watching on as well, that's a memory that a lot of us treasure. So thanks for being a part of that, I think.
That's cool. Yeah, it's, like I said, when you're in Australia, it's, you don't realise the support you're getting because obviously the time difference, and you don't see it as much as when you're over in England because you're on the same time frame. So when we arrive back, it kind of hits home like what you've actually achieved. And you know, I started walking down the street and people actually kind of knew who I was, which I wasn't. it was good, and it was a good time for cricket, and it did seem like a lot, you know, like 2005, everyone seemed to be behind the team at the time, and social media started to kind of have a bit of a hype, and Swanee doing the sprinkler dance and all those things. It was a good time to be involved in the England team.
Well, I remember being at university and I'd be watching it at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and like someone would get a wicket and you'd just scream like, come on! And then the foreign guys in my block were just like, who the hell is this guy? Why do you shouting at this stupid time?
Yeah.
So England were whitewashed 5-0, as you mentioned, but kind of on the previous tour of 2006-07. So you're turning up and it's a bit of a cauldron, I can imagine. But what was the feeling in the camp like when you turned up in 2010-11?
I think in 2000, I was involved in 2006, 2007, the one-day series. And again, we got whitewashed 5-0 by that great side with Shane Warne and McGrath and all those guys. And in that one-day series, even though we actually came away winning that one-day series, a lot of the guys were shot away. You know, guys were going out, getting pissed every night during games. Everyone was kind of a bit shot away. Going into that series in 2010, I think there's a lot of confidence building into that series, and Andy Flower had built up a squad of players that I guess with no baggage, and I think going into that, you know, that series, we believed that we could win, and I think going into the warm-up games, we treated every game really seriously. It wasn't a warm-up, it was like we're going to try and win every single game, and I think we pretty much won every game in the warm-ups, and we went into the first test full of confidence. Didn't go great. I think Andrew Strauss got a third or fourth ball. But obviously we managed to pull it back and draw that game, and the kind of momentum shifted when Cook and Trotty batted, you know, all day on the fifth day. And then early wickets at Adelaide. I didn't play in that game, but early wickets and a run out from Trotty at Adelaide. Yeah, the momentum just seemed to kind of go our way. And once we won that game at Adelaide, the confidence certainly grew, and the fans got behind us, and we got to Melbourne and Sydney, and it just felt the whole of the country was behind us, even though we're in another country. So yeah, it was great.
Well, I heard in the build up to that you went away and on some kind of camp, and you broke or cracked a rib, James Anderson's rib. Is that, can you verify that, or is that internet conjecture?
There is a film out called The Edge, actually, and they do have a little bit of behind the scenes footage of that trip in Germany. Which certainly was, I actually got a lot out of that trip. It was probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. 3 or 4 days away in Germany, we didn't know where we were going. We were kind of like, you know, bags and put in a minibus and we turned up and it was like, get out the car, put a backpack on and carrying bricks over our head and like doing press ups in the middle of the night. It was -5 degrees. It was really tough, but it kind of really brought us together, I think. You know, some people, like KP, said it was an absolute waste of time and he didn't get anything out of it and he couldn't have his mobile phone for 4 days.
What a shock.
He found that pretty difficult. But yeah, certainly being out the side for myself, I'd been out the squad for a couple of years, so coming in and being involved again, it certainly felt like I was kind of back in the mix. And you know, everyone being in an uncomfortable environment brought a lot of people closer together. And that moment you spoke about, we were meant to have, I can't remember who it was, Joe Calzacchi, I think, was meant to come and do some boxing training. For some reason, he couldn't make it, but we ended up doing this boxing anyway. And for some reason, I was paired up against Jimmy Anderson and literally put a head guard on and just try and beat the shit out of each other. And, you know, your natural instinct is when someone starts hitting you is to hit them back. And I whacked Jimmy really, really hard in his ribs. And he cracked a rib. And actually, I think I fought Andrew Strauss and Tim Bresnan maybe as well. And I actually had a bit of a dodgy rib for him. I'm not sure it was the best idea. It was quite a good fun at the time. And I remember Craig Keyswick and Kevin Peterson were literally having a proper brawl and like properly going at each other. But I think Jimmy Anderson had a cracked rib for about 4 weeks, and it was a bit touch and go by the first test. But luckily, he was fine.
Yeah. There's old Ashley Giles worried about England playing football before the warm up, and then you guys just be a boxing.
Yeah, no, it was interesting. Yeah, definitely. So, I'm not sure they do it again. things have changed a little bit, but yeah, no, it was something I'll never forget. It was. Was pretty surreal, and we were certainly put out of our comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, talking about comfort zones, I mean, in Perth, you kind of got, we're on the receiving end of a bit of a drubbing. But personally, you did pretty well. I mean, you've got the scalps of soon-to-be best batsman of all time, Steve Smith,
yeah.
and Michael Clarke, and then obviously Mr. Cricket himself, Michael Hussey. So how did that kind of feel? Did it give you the confidence that you could play at the highest level?
Yeah, I mean, I played a few tests before in 2007. I was out the side for about 3 years. So I knew I was kind of good enough to be involved and wanted to get back in the squad eventually, or team eventually. And when Stuart Ball got injured in Adelaide, I knew there was going to be a spot available. And it worked out that the bounciest pitch in the world was, the next game about. And obviously, I'm the tallest bowler in the side. So, and I bowled quite well. We had a game in between and I bowled quite well in that game. And luckily got the nod. It's the best I've ever bowled in my career, to be fair, bowling up. So I think it was a fairly easy decision to give me the nod for that test match. But I remember the night before, I literally didn't sleep the whole night before. I wasn't nervous. I was excited, but my brain was just rattling, like, you know, how's it going to go? And you know, how am I going to bowl? Just, you know, and just kind of going through previous experiences I've had in Australia years and years before, because I've actually been over there a lot and had experience with bowling in Australia. So it was just trying to, making sure I was bowling the fuller length and not get carried away with bowling too short. I didn't sleep the whole night, but went out pretty nervous, excited. And I think I got a wicket with my third ball. I bowled Philip Hughes with an absolute beauty from nowhere. And just that just settles the nerves straight away and settled into my spell quite nicely. And I think I had two or three wickets at lunchtime and I managed to get Steve Smith out and I think Michael Clarke. Bowled nicely and I think got 5 wickets in the second innings. But, you know, on the losing side, you know, Mitchell Johnson turned up that game and bowled unbelievable. He started swinging the ball around and, you know, I had to face him. I just couldn't even see him. swinging it round corners. And he bowled, I don't think he bowled great in the first, I think he played in the first test, didn't bowl very well. He got dropped for the second test and then came back for the third test and bowled great, but then for the rest of the series he didn't turn up again. But that test in Perth, he was unplayable and bowled really quick and got it swinging around. Luckily we were able to bounce back pretty quickly for the rest of the tour. But yeah, from a personal note, I certainly took a lot of confidence taking 7 or 8 wickets in that test match and feeling confident going to a 95,000 seat stadium in Melbourne.
Well, I was going to say, so I mean, playing in the Boxing Day Test is surely it's a cricketer's dream, really. And like you've got, as you say, like 95,000, 100,000 people. One of our followers, Grace's Cricket Club, have asked, kind of, what was that like? What was the feeling like going into that environment?
Yeah, it's just absolutely incredible. You know, I think again, like during my career, it was always you'd watch, you know, Australia, England on TV, and when the Boxing Day Test match came about, I was like, yeah, I want to do that one day. And I guess as my career kind of went on, it was like another 4 years, I'm not going to play. Another 4 years, not going to play. Kind of working out, am I going to get that chance? And yeah, luckily, you know, the stars aligned, and I got picked for that trip, and was in the team for that test match. And yeah, just turning up, it was like, it's like no other experience you can ever have, just because the amount of people that are in the ground, and like I said, it's just like a Coliseum type atmosphere. And I always just remember bowling my first couple of balls to Phil Hughes, and he crunched me for four. Never heard a noise like it. Actually kind of made me jump when I followed through. It was like, oh, what was that? It was so loud. And yeah, just really intimidating. But at the same time, really made you concentrate and, you know, try harder. And I think I went for eight in my first over and was like, geez, I need to like get a wicket here. A couple of maidens, and then I bowled an absolute jaffa to Shane Watson in the second over, and again it just settled the nerve. And but there you
was it an LBW by any chance?
It was the only time it wasn't an LBW.
I watched the spell today, Rod. It's just outside off stump, and it lifts on him, and it's basically unplayable.
yeah, that one. But yeah, the rest of the time, whenever he got struck on the pad, he was. It was quite funny. We're in the huddle and we were just, you know, Kate was chirping and going, what are you? No, that's out. Why? it was quite good fun. And he just kept doing his LBWs and getting whacked on the pad and just playing across his front pad. But that experience was just incredible. Just the noise and bowling them out for just after lunch or whatever it was. I can't even.
I think 98.
Yeah,
98. So you've got pretty much 95,000 Aussies, yeah. And you just get to kind of stand there going, I've just taken four of these.
Yeah, it was weird because the weather wasn't actually that great. I mean, we were on and off for rain, and it was drizzling, and then all of a sudden it got really muggy and hot around lunchtime, and then Jimmy Anderson got three or four wickets in absolutely no time, and all of a sudden they were like 70 for seven or something, and it's like, oh my God, what's going on? And then we clean them up for 98, and then I remember Strousey and Cookie went out to bat, and the sun just like came out, and it was like, this is just perfect game. And at the end of the day, we were 100 off and none. It's like we've won the game. We're not going to lose this game. We batted for 2 days, and it was fun. You bowled 10-15 overs, put your feet up for two or three days, and then go out and try and bowl them out again. And obviously we did that. It was a bit more hard work second time round, but just the perfect test match. And to do it in front of 95,000 people at the start of the day, by the end of the day there was about 20,000 people in the ground, because they'd all had enough and they'd all left. They knew the game was probably over. So yeah, very, very satisfying, because, you know, having been there in 2007, seeing it from an outsider's point of view, and being there in 2013 in the squad but not playing and getting absolutely thrashed again, it just wasn't very nice. So to have that experience to say I've been there and won there is pretty cool.
Yeah. How about playing with some of those guys? Because you were in that series particularly, you were a key player in that side. What was it like being around Swan and Peterson? And, well, I mean, like, you could legitimately, you could say six or seven of those players could be in England's, will be in the frame for England's best ever 11.
I think it was, again, like a great, great, great kind of squad to be involved in. A lot of those players, I was involved in the National Academy, which kind of started in early 2000, 2001. And I was kind of like one of the really young guys. I was only 19, 20. And, Strousey, Flintoff, Graham Swan, a lot of you know, great players played in that kind of that side. We were in that environment for two years, 6 months training in that environment. So I got to kind of grow up quite quickly and be around that environment and kind of learn quite quickly what it would take to get my fitness levels up to that kind of standard. And, you know, I need to try and get on a yard or two of pace to kind of get up to these guys. You know, had Harmison in the nets, watching him bowl when I was young. It's like, oh my God, this guy's incredible. He's going so much. it just kind of made me learn quite quickly. And just great to be around those guys at an early age. And then just to be in the same side of them. I guess in the end, you take it for granted, and you just kind of get used to it. And I played with these guys a lot on, you know, A-sides and on the county circuit. So you get to know them personally from a different level, and then obviously you come together in a team, and they're your colleagues, but they do become your mates at the same time because you're spending so much time together. But yeah, it's just, you know, generally, you know, we had the odd fallout more towards in 2013 when things weren't going so well. But generally, you know, everyone got on pretty well. Even if they weren't getting on as mates, you know, they respected each other in the team as, you know, what they could do as a player. Everyone would, you know, once you step over that line, it was like, you know, do your job, and, you know, KP would go out there and get runs. And if he was out driving Lamborghinis around Melbourne, people off the field, you know, once he went out there and scored 100, no one really cared what he was doing off the field. I mean, people would wind you up at times, you know, the all the stories always about KP and things like that. And, you know, the attention was taken away from Swanee and some of these guys who like the attention as well. But once we stepped over the line, you know, especially in those big test matches, it was like, right, we're playing as a team, get the job done. So that was the main thing. And more often than not, certainly in that period when we got to number one, when we stepped over the line, we did the business.
Another player that we're sort of semi-fascinated with on this podcast is Monty Panesar. What was it like spending time with Monty?
Yeah, I mean, I've known Monty a long time. We're actually the same age. So I kind of played with him under 19s cricket and all the way through, and you know, played with him in the academy, A-sides and for England. Yeah, he's a hard one to kind of describe, really, because he was such a timid, kind of quiet chap, kind of, until he was in his, you know, mid to late 20s. And then, I don't know, for personal reasons, he just kind of went off the boil a little bit. And, you know, I guess when people do well for England and then, you know, they're in and out the side. And, you know, I think Monty has taken a lot, over 150 wickets, I think, for England.
Yeah, he's bowled well. He's a good
athlete. He was England's main spinner for a long time. And I think when Graham Swan came along and kind of became the number one spinner, I don't know if it changed his mindset or he put more pressure on himself, and other things, external things from outside of cricket kind of started to affect him. I'm not sure. And no one really knows the true story. And look, I can't, you know, I still see Monty to this day, and I don't understand him. I don't sometimes know how he operates. He's very funny, and he's got that deep down, he's got a heart of gold. And he loves the game. He loves the game more than probably anyone in that squad. He just wants to go out there and do well. He wants to take wickets. And he's, like I said, he's the type of guy that will go back to his local club and play club cricket every Saturday. I've got no interest in doing that at all. I don't love the game that much. And you know, now I'm retired, I couldn't think of anything worse. But it just shows how much kind of passion and love he's got for the game. And, you know, you see his Twitter and his Instagram, like, with these crazy things he's doing and doing, you know, he's like bench pressing a chair and doing dips on a chair. I mean, it's quite entertaining to watch. You know, I think he's just trying to find himself after cricket. But on the pitch, you know, just a very passionate guy. And, you know, when he was out there, even with his batting, you could see how hard he was trying, you know, his eyes were like, you know, with room, because he's trying to watch the ball so much, especially in that, you know, that game at Cardiff when he drew it out with Jimmy Anderson. But it's just a trier and just a lover of the game. And just, unfortunately, I think, you know, things have just, you know, been in and out the side, and pressures outside in his personal life has caused him to be in the media at times for the wrong reasons, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I think all England fans will have a special place in their heart for Monty Panesar.
I think he deserves it. You know, he was kind of like a cult kind of character, wasn't he? And
yeah, a cult character who played 50 Test matches. So
yeah, exactly. People forget that's a lot of games for England. And he's taken a lot of wickets, and he's won a lot of games for England. You know, people who can remember that far back, you know, will remember that he was, you know, at his best. He was a top class spinner, and he got Sachin Tendulkar fun. You know, and time was the best.
Yeah, not a bad bunny to have that, is it?
Yeah, exactly.
I think you could have done with a Monty Panesar celebration, actually.
I'm not sure that would have suited me. I'm a bit more reserved, but that was the funny thing about Monty, because he was so reserved and so quiet. You know, he wouldn't in a team in the dressing room, he wouldn't speak to anyone, and then you take a wicket and all of a sudden he's like off running around the ground, and it's like, where did this come from? It was just like bizarre. But like you said, he created this character, and the fans just absolutely loved him. It's a bit like Imran Tahir for South Africa, you know, Hampshire, just a really quiet, lovely guy, and then he turns up playing for Hampshire and he gets a wicket, and all of a sudden he's in the groundsman hat celebrating. It's like, where's this guy gone? So yeah, some guys just have such a passion when they take a wicket. It really just shows how much they love the game.
Mm-hmm. So moving back in time, so to the 2005 Ashes, so you were 12th man on a few occasions.
Yeah, I was
there
in the squad for the first four tests, and then I missed out for the last one, but yeah, I was in the squad.
So when it comes to this, so you've obviously been involved in some of like the highest points of English cricket from our memory, you know, from our living memory. Kind of around that kind of team, what was that like? Because that seems like quite a different team to the one that won Down Under in Australia.
Yeah, I think things were quite different then. You know, there weren't. I think central contracts were just coming about then, so there was certainly. I don't know if there was central contracts then, but there was certainly more inconsistency with selection like around that time. But during that 2005 Ashes, you know, they picked a squad of 12 and they kept it for that four. But, you know, from a personal level, I felt like I didn't know where I was at sometimes with the selection policy. And, you know, I'd find out on the radio if I was in the squad or not. And it's certainly changed a lot now. And with central contracts, you know, when I was involved in 2010, I felt, a lot more looked after, especially as like an injury-prone bowler. I didn't feel like in 2005, the setup was there to kind of look after an injury-prone bowler like myself. Whereas now, like, you know, Jofra Archer and Mark Wood, you know, they're looked after and their overs are monitored. And, you know, I might have lasted a little bit longer in this era. But no, I think in that, you know, that era, it was, that was just a changing point for English cricket. And I came in I was bowling very well. I think I deserved the place in the squad. But it was a little bit of a surprise and certainly very daunting to kind of be involved in such a big thing. And it came out of nowhere, really. And we got absolutely thrashed in the first test. But at the same time, I remember just the belief that the guys had. And there wasn't that kind of fear factor that I think they'd had in other years. Obviously, sort of, you know, some of the guys in the squad, the Vaughan, Stryskoffic, they were a lot older than me. And they'd had a bit more baggage against Australia in 2001 and 2004 in these types of things, but yeah, there was that belief really, and you know, even when we got absolutely thrashed at Lords, that went to Edgbaston, and obviously McGrath stepped on the ball, and I remember this confidence kind of went around the dressing room when McGrath stepped on the ball, and England went out there, and I think, you know, Ricky Ponting made a pretty bad call on the toss, and you know, Michael Vaughan said, right, we've just got to take advantage and be positive, and I think England were 400 after the first day. Obviously, the game turned out being really, really close, you know, one by two runs or whatever, three runs. But again, just that momentum shift, winning that game, it just changed. And the momentum just, there's just that belief there that we can beat these guys. And Shane Warne isn't invincible, because there was always this thing about Shane Warne just being unplayable and how are we going to play him and he's going to get in our heads. And I think there's just so much baggage with him and McGrath. Once they kind of got over that and want to get that game at Edgbaston, and I turned up for the squad at Old Trafford and Trent Bridge, there was just such a different feeling and a confidence. It was like, yeah, these guys are going to go out and do the business. And it was unfortunate that they didn't carry on that kind of momentum longer. You know, I guess 2005, we won the Ashes, and whether we got carried away and, you know, we didn't back it up for long enough, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it matters, because we'll always remember that series just because it was such a tight, great series. And it certainly made people watch cricket again, and obviously I think at the time it was on terrestrial TV and Channel 4, so you know, a lot of people were watching it. So yeah, it was, for me, I was 22, 23, kind of making my way in the game, but I didn't get to play. I was in the squad, but it was just a great thing for me to watch and be involved in, and go, God, I'd love to do that one day. And it kept me motivated. You know, when I did get injured every year, having another operation, it's like, just remember that, you know, 2005 series, you can really make your name for yourself. If you do well in an Ashes series, people will remember you. Even Gary Pratt, you know, got that run out. People just because he got a run out. So it just shows, you know, you can play a test match against India and Pakistan and people won't really remember who you are or what you did. But if you do it against Australia in a big occasion, people will remember those occasions, because it's such a big occasion for cricket. As we know, the Ashes is the biggest contest in Test cricket.
And you must have the best seat in the house, right, as well. What's it like sitting on the Lord's balcony? Just kind of be like, this is rather good.
Yeah, I mean, it was, yeah, back in there, yeah. I think it's still the same now, but you'd basically be there for like the first day or the first couple of days, and then unfortunately you'd have to go back and play for your camp. You'd kind of watch, especially at Lord's, the best thing about Lord's was having the lunch, so you'd say to the manager, oh, I'd stay for a couple of days, you know. Yeah,
especially if you're not bowling.
Yeah, I'll just do a bit of bowling in the nets rather than go back to. But yeah, no, Lord's was great, and yeah, it was just great to watch, you know, the legends, you know, Warren, even on the other side, but the legends like Warren McGrath, and then Harmison, you know, I just, yeah, even Harmison, he was a bit erratic. I just loved watching, but yeah, when he got it right and he bowled quick, I just loved watching Harmison bowl, Flintoff bowl at their best. And, you know, Harmison on that first set, Lord bowled in, came in and bowled absolutely rapid and hit Ponting in the face. And he got 5 wickets, I think, and he came off. And I just remember he came in and he ate, he actually came in and ate a whole cheesecake. He was, Harmy just absolutely loved his food. Like, you know, he's put on a few stone now. But I remember he bowled his overs and got 5 wickets, and he came out and he went, oh, get me one of those cheesecakes. And it's like, he didn't just have a slither. He literally had like the whole thing. And he just, he'd sit there, and when he wasn't bowling, when we were batting, he'd just eat and eat and eat and eat. Yeah, everyone would want to take advantage at Lord's.
You mentioned the Shane Warne, and you mentioned earlier Ricky Ponting. You're maybe not unique, but possibly unique in English cricket in that you were in the same dressing room as both of them, I think, in county cricket, yeah. as well as being sort of on the opposite side of the fence. What are those two like for and against, if you get what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I was incredibly lucky to play with guys like that, especially at Hampshire. I mean, Shane Warne came over as our captain for 3 or 4 years. And I don't, you know, I've said it before, but I don't think I would have been the player I was if I hadn't had him as my captain. And, you know, I always could bowl, and I always had an inner confidence in myself, but there was always something, whether it's about my body language or I just wasn't getting it quite right. And Shane Warne kind of made me realise what I had to do to kind of get to the next level. It was like, you know, this is where you need to get aggressive at this time, and this is the way you got to bowl here. And, you know, there'll be times when my body language might be poor, and I didn't know, but he's like, he's telling me, like, you need to lift your shoulders or whatever. It's just little things that kind of made me really, you know, kind of realise if I wanted to get to the next level, I had to kind of improve and change. And he certainly got the best out of me at Hampshire and made me learn what I needed to do to get that level. And I remember he had a book that came out and he signed it, and he said, in my nickname's Goober, he said, Goober, I hope the penny has dropped. And he signed it, Shane Warne. And I remember that. It's like, yeah, it has. And I, you know, even though he didn't think I was listening, I was always taking in the things that he was saying. And yeah, see, and it's just like I said, he played for Australia, and he was Australian. But he, again, like Monty Panesar, just had such a passion for the game. And whether he's playing for Hampshire in a Division 2 game against Glamorgan, or whether it was a test match, he'd have the same sort of passion to go out there and just want to win. He was inspirational for our dressing room and for me, and I certainly learned a lot off him. Didn't really get to play against him, but I certainly played with him a lot. Played a lot of county cricket with him, and then saw him obviously during that 2005 Ashes from the dressing room. And then Ricky Ponting, I played a bit against obviously in Australia, and then he came and played for Surrey for a couple of years. And yeah, just expectations of when you play against someone like this little aggressive man. Genius, but so aggressive in your face, you know, when you're batting, just like in your face, thinking you're a lanky piece of shit, whatever, like so intimidating as such a small guy as well. So but you know, someone I like idolized growing up watching him play that hook shot into the ground, you know, just like he's, you know, just a fantastic player. So bowling at him for the first time, I remember at Perth, I think my first couple of balls to him, or third ball to him, it was back of length, and he just pulled me for 4, and I thought, Jesus, this guy, he's going to try and take me on. He's just really hard to bowl to. And because I was like, you know, I knew his tactic was to kind of go hard at me, and that's what he does. If he can see a weakness in someone, or if he can take someone down, he'll go at you hard. And he is very hard to bowl to. But as a guy coming to Surrey, just such a different guy in person, such a gentleman, like such a lovely guy, with throw balls to all the youngsters, you know, try and help them out. Headingley, I remember we were away for a couple of days, making all the guys cups of tea. Ricky Ponting's like carrying in trays of tea for all the Surrey boys. It's like, this is really surreal. Ricky Ponting's making me a cup of tea. This shouldn't be how it is. We should all be like, you know, bowing to whatever. But yeah, just you know, it's like a lot of the overseas players that come over. You do get a few guys that think they're, you know, at times bigger than the game or whatever. But generally, the Australian guys and the South African guys, when they come over, they're just normal people, and they're just really nice guys. And been lucky enough to play with so many good overseas players and get to know them personally. And like I said, more times than not, they're just really nice people. Yeah, just to play with two legends like that was great. And Amla, Sangakkara, these guys, you know, just very blessed to be able to, you know, walk on the same field as these guys. Graham Smith, you know, these, you know, absolute legends in the game. Just very lucky to have those experiences and catch the cricket with these guys.
So, cricket is one of those things where, as you say, you get to always play with your mates, and sometimes you end up playing with people you don't really want to play with. Was there anyone in particular that you kind of grew up playing that you just loved playing cricket with?
Loved playing cricket. Yeah.
It's okay to say no. I mean, cricket is a very individual kind of sport, and you can be like, actually, Chris Tremlett is who I want to be, and I don't like anyone else.
It's like guys I grew up, you know, there's a few guys I grew up in Hampshire with, just, you know, through their age group. So, as simple as it sounds, it's just, you know, I played with like Jimmy Adams at Hampshire, for example. I played with him when I was 10 or 11, and then all of a sudden you're playing in the first team together and winning games in a championship game. It's not as glamorous as playing for England or whatever, but just some of those guys in county cricket that I, you know, like I said, grew up playing with when I was 12 13, and then you go on to play professional games with these guys and share a dressing room, and you see each other grow up and go through different stages of your life. That is quite cool and quite special. And all those guys today, they're still guys that I keep in touch with, and you've got such a bond with because you've known them for so long and you've had so many different experiences with each other. And, you know, the guys you play against with England, it's like you're in and out the side, and you don't, you know, the England dressing room compared to the county dressing room is slightly different. The county dressing room is like your family because you're with them all the time. In the winter, you're training with each other. You get to know these guys so well, and they do become your friends. And, you know, England, if you're in the side all the time, that's a similar scenario. But for me, because I was in and out the side, and, you know, I was in with different areas, you know, the 2005 era, 2010 era, you know, you don't get to know people quite as well. They're more like colleagues or acquaintances. But certainly some of the guys in county cricket, they've you know, become real good friends, and, you know, when I see them, it's like nothing's changed, and you've all those cool memories and that you talk about, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Was there anyone you didn't get on with? Did you have a rivalry with anyone that kind of ever, not bubbled over, but was always quite, was there?
Not really. I think I'm pretty, you know, laid back, you know, kind of guy, but the only guy that really wound me up was David Warner. I don't not like Dave Warner, but I just thought he was a bit of a twat, really. You know, just
a controversial answer there.
Yeah, just do things. I'm like, what, you know, why are you doing that? Why would you say that? You know, like, you know, even when, you know, Jonathan Trott got out in Brisbane or whatever, he's saying, oh, you know, Trott's scared and all this. It's like, just stupid, dumb things to say. And, you know, you can, it's the Aussie kind of way, but, you know, just certain things you did, and it was just silly. And I just remember in 2013, you know, just I'd be running on with drinks, and he's like sledging me at point. I'm like, mate, I'm carrying the drinks on. You don't have to sledge me. And he'd literally just be going so hard at me. And it's like, mate, there's no need for this. But yeah, I just thought he was just one guy that was just a bit irritating. But I can't really think of too many others. There would have been a few teammates in county cricket throughout the year. They would have done the odd thing that would wound me up. But no, there's not too many. There's no one I'd say I hate, or they've done something so badly that I, you know, want to kill them, type of thing. But
yeah, it must have been terrible for you watching Stuart Broad destroy David Warner last year.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, he would just be one guy that really wound me up. So yeah, seeing Broadie clean him up last year, and, you know, obviously like the sandpaper thing, it was like... You know, it's like, it doesn't surprise me he'd do something like that, because, you know, just things I've kind of seen before. But, yeah, he kind of really, you know, be the only one.
Yeah. One of the other things we asked pretty much all of our guests, we're keen tourists on this podcast. What's your favourite cricket tour that you've been on?
Again, like, the Ashes was hard to beat. Yeah. I mean,
that's right. You can say that.
Yeah. I think the Caribbean is probably the best one to go on in terms of, you know, where you are and back. And I didn't actually do one with England, but I've been there a couple of times with counties and other trips. But for me, the Ashes always sticks out because I just remember we literally won every single game. Social media wasn't big then. It was only just starting. Twitter had literally just about started. So we were going out. If we won a game, we were out all night, every night. Everything. I was single, having the time of my life, you know, picking up women left, right and centre. Just having the dream tour, really. So it didn't get any better than that. We won every game apart from Perth, I think. We went out and got pissed every time we won, which was every week. And it was great. And, you know, having done it in 2006 and 7 on the other end, and, you know, we're getting wallops and getting abused by the Aussies every single time. And then 2010, the Aussies, they like you go out and they go, oh, yeah, they're on our side. It felt like they were on our side. And you went back again in 13. It was like you go out and people just shouting you down the street. Like, this isn't nice. I'll stay in my hotel room again. But it was just a nice time to be in Australia and just a nice time to win. But I've been lucky enough to go on so many, you know, good tours and been to so many times. That's a great place to go. And they got the vineyards and, you know, nice things to do. Caribbean, again, Blue Sea and whatever. You know, India, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, those Bangladesh, they're the ones that aren't so glamorous because the security reasons and those sort of things, you're kind of nailed into your hotel a little bit. So those tours do drag on a little bit and you have to kind of find things to do between yourselves, you know, between games. And, you know, sometimes you start real early because of for the daylight there. Like sometimes you start the game at 9 a.m. So it's a bit of a different experience and the food is different and you generally get the shits a couple of times when you're there as well. Australia, South Africa, Caribbean, they're the great tours and they're always good.
I think that's more or less David Gower's answer as well.
Yeah, not, I think, you know, like I said, now social media is bigger. You can't do the things you used to be able to do. You know, there's always going to be someone taking a picture of you or they'll be looking over your shoulder like what you're doing. So it's you can't enjoy it quite as much as we used to. I mean, going back to the early 2000s in county cricket, I mean, that was different, you know, every single night of the game. You know, how the game has moved on in the last 20 years is very different. But I'm very grateful to have seen both sides of it, you know, getting pissed every day during a four-day game to, you know, taking it mega seriously and doing fitness every day. You know, it's I've seen kind of two sides to different eras. So, but me, certainly, like I said, it's very professional now. And, you know, I think the intensity of the game has gone up and it's kind of clear to see, you know. It is different. You can't get away with going out every night and getting on the beer every night.
Well, you'll be happy to know in amateur cricket that
still happens. Yeah. That's good. It's good to know.
A little bit closer to home. You, according to Ross's research, you're the fourth grandson of a grandfather to play Test cricket. Your dad, in between you and your granddad, didn't play Test cricket. Was that ever tense at Christmas dinner?
No, it wasn't tense, but my dad is actually he's quietly competitive. I think my granddad played three tests and I haven't played loads, but I played 10. But my dad was a very good county player. I think he played for 15, 16 years and obviously played in a slightly different era. But, you know, he was nothing glamorous. I think he was like a, you know, 75, 78 mile hour medium pacer. He did a job, averaged 22 and then got, you know, average 23, 24 with the bat. But didn't play for England. And actually, when I passed him, I think he got 450 odd wickets. And once I passed him, it was weird. I kind of, my motivation actually kind of dropped a little, kind of beat my dad a little bit. Coincidentally with a few injuries and stuff. But I certainly remember when I got past him in first class wickets, I certainly collected and said, you know, I've got more wickets than you. But obviously got the England kind of, hat over him, but I think he kind of realised, you know, with my height and my pace, if I, you know, make the most of my attributes and my potential, I always had the chance to go on and play for England from that perspective. Joking apart, he was also one of my reasons for playing the game and wanting to, you know, succeed and go on and play the game. And you know, 16, 17, I kind of discovered drink and alcohol and going out. And, you know, kind of got a little bit drawn towards that. And he was like, well, if you really want to take this seriously, you're going to have to, you know, not do that as much. And you can't go on holiday with your mates in the summer. You're going to have to make a few sacrifices and do the right thing. So he was certainly a, you know, kind of stern, gave me some stern advice at the right times to make it. And even though he would, you know, give me advice that I didn't want to listen to him because of my dad, he was generally right. So if I was really struggling, I'd go and speak to my dad and say, you know, any suggestions, what do you think? And he was always a good kind of go-to. And my years at Hampshire, he was always there as a director of cricket at the time. So it was always good to have him
on your side.
Even though I kind of made out I never listened to him, I like Shane Warne, I was always worth listening. Yeah, he was good to have around.
Oh, so I love that. After the Ashes series, so when it all went very well, you went to Sri Lanka and you kind of rolled through Sri Lanka. Well, it was in England, I think. I mean, after taking the wickets of like big name batsmen, I mean, like Jar Wardner was on there. We've already spoken about Steve Smith and Michael Hussey. Was there a favourite wicket of yours, or did you have a bunny? Do we like bunnies on here?
Well, I think Steve Smith was actually. I think I've got him out four or five times. So I wouldn't say he was my bunny, but yeah, 50 odd wickets, and I've got him out four or five times. But no, I actually found him, even though I got him out a few times, you could always kind of tell he had something special about him. He had a little bit more time than some of the other guys. And I think it took him just a little bit longer to find himself. And, you know, he kind of started out as a spinner that bowled a bit. And I think when he kind of believed that he was in the team as a batsman and not this kind of spinning all rounder or whatever, he kind of went to the next level. But he was always kind of awkward to bowl. So even, you know, I remember at Sydney in 2011, even though the game was gone, he batted it on the last day and got 50 or 60. And he just hit the ball in really weird areas. It's like, how's he hit me there? That's a really good shot. And those guys can be the toughest guys to bowl to. You know, like your Tendulkars and Dravids and those guys, they're so hard to get them out. But you knew if you bowled your best ball, they'd respect it or leave it. Like guys like Hayden and Gilchrist and Steve Smith, Warner, those sort of players, they hit your best balls to four and you go back going, oh, that's my best ball. Where am I going? I found that quite difficult to bowl at players like that. Darren Lehman was another one in county cricket. He would just walk across and whip me over square leg for four or six out of nowhere. And it'd be one of my good length balls. And it was like, well, if you've done that, where am I going to bowl my next one? You kind of get in your head. So, but no, I wouldn't say I had any bunnies. I just preferred bowling to good, solid players because I knew if I bowled my best ball to them or, you know, good line of length ball, they would respect it. And I guess my kind of tactic of bowling really was to keep it pretty, like McGrath, keep it pretty simple, just bowl line of length. You know, the odd one's going to, you know, vary off a length or whatever and the batsman will make the mistake. That was generally my way of bowling. At times I would try and go a little bit more aggressive if the pitch suited, but yeah, my tactic was pretty boring, just bowl my best ball every ball. So yeah, those kind of good players like your Tendulkars and Dravids and that would respect your ball, I found them easy to bowl to, but the guys that really went after me, I found them a little bit more hard work.
Yeah. I'm going back to a little bit earlier in the interview, you mentioned The Edge, the like documentary film that kind of covers Andy Flower's tenure as coach. What was Andy like to play under? Because you kind of hear two versions. You hear the Peterson story, and then you hear the Strauss version of events, if you like, and they are quite different.
I'd probably sit in the middle. Like certainly when I came back into the setup, I thought Andy was absolutely brilliant. Generally, throughout my 3 or 4 years in that kind of period, I was a bit in and out. I had a back surgery in between, knee surgery as well. But he was, I just thought he was brilliant, you know, his way of kind of going about things. And it was whenever we won, even though we wanted to go out and party and celebrate, it was always about, right, we've done that. It's now, we're moving on to the next game. We forget about that. And, you know, when we won the Ashes and, you know, things like that, we'd celebrate, like we had one night and we celebrated and it was like, right, that's it. You're not celebrating. And it was like, come on, Andy, we've just won the Ashes. Like, give us a few nights out or whatever. It was like, no, we trained like 2 days after the night we won the Ashes. It was like, God, look, give us a bit of time off. But that was how kind of driven he was as a coach. And, you know, he was always kind of wanted to move forward and get better. And it was like, the aim was to get to number one. And when we won the Ashes in 10-11, we weren't number one. I think we were still number three or whatever. We still had a lot of work to do to get, you know, beat Sri Lanka and beat India to get to number one. So it was always that next goal. But yeah, it was always quite intense under Andy. He was quite an intense coach. And then we had a management management team around him that, you know, you go to, you know, David Saker would be my kind of go-to as the bowling coach. And then some of my batting stuff, I'd speak to Graham Gooch and then occasionally Andy Flower. But yeah, he was kind of like, during sessions, he kind of would be fairly intense, but, you know, sit from the background. But then we'd have a team meeting, he would be, you know, there heading it and saying how it is, really. And I think he, you know, like I said, he's just a good, honest coach. And I think communication most of the time during his reign was very good. I just think the only time it kind of went a bit tits up, really, was in 13. You know, we started losing. Graham Swan left the tour three games down at Perth, and it became, yeah, quite difficult from that moment on. And I think no one really wanted to be there when we were 3-0 down going to Melbourne. And one of the senior players had left and, you know, said he was going to retire. And then Andy, yeah, he just got very intense and, you know, kind of everyone started squabbling and everyone went off the rails. So it did kind of end a little bit sour, and people did fall out. But, you know, as a whole, over, you know, what is he, 4 or 5 years, and I worked with him as well before he became England coach. I think he's an excellent coach and an excellent man manager. And that is the hardest thing about being a coach, is you've got, you know, 20, 25 guys in a squad, you know, in and out over a few years. You've got to manage and you've got to try and keep their expectations high. And you want them, you know, if they're in and out the side, you want them to come back, and you've got to tell them the right thing. So it is a very, very hard job. You don't appreciate how hard it is doing that type of job. It's not really the coaching, it's the managing of players. And especially when you've got some big names and big egos like Swans, Broads, Andersons, Petersons, all, you know, trying to get them all to merge and get on and be the best players they can, it can be quite tough. But yeah, credit to Andy over his period of time in general. You know, he got us to number one when we were pretty average in 2009. He saw a vision and we went in a direction all together and he drove it, really, along with Andy Strauss. He was a fantastic leader, you know, very kind of militant. But yeah, those two together were a fantastic unit, and I really, really enjoyed playing under them.
I mean, you talk around the fallout of kind of that tour. What did you kind of make of it? Because, I mean, from an outside perspective, it's obviously blown out of all kind of proportions. It's like it's the front page of the Red Tops, and you're kind of sitting there. Well, actually, from an internal bit, was it just a natural end of the cycle for Andy Flower's kind of reign?
Yeah, I mean, we just, you know, I think we, I remember we got to Australia thinking we're going to absolutely wipe the floor with Australia. We beat them quite easily at home, and they weren't playing their best cricket, but I remember Mitchell Johnson bowled, I think we played him in a one day series in England, and he bowled pretty quick. And, you know, I remember Jonathan Trott saying, oh yeah, he did bowl pretty quick. And Matt Pryor saying, oh yeah, he bowled quick in that one day series. If only he could get it together in Australia. I think there was always that threat of Mitchell Johnson, if he could get it right, there would be, you know, they could challenge us a little bit. But the overriding kind of feeling was definitely like, we're going to thrash these guys again. And then I think we got to Brisbane and it all went horribly wrong on that first day. We got bowled out cheaply and whatever. And Mitchell Johnson did turn up and bowl incredibly fast. Like, scared. And, you know, guys were coming in going, they were, you know, they weren't scared, but they were like, that is seriously, seriously fast. You know, that is, I'm really having to work to play that. I played in that first test match and faced them. And that was, yeah, it's probably the fastest, you know, I remember seeing Brad Haddin 30, 40 feet back. Was incredible where he was taking the ball and how fast he was bowling. So as a tail ender, it was not fun to face that. I remember going back to the hotel when we lost that game, and just the mood just completely changed. And Matt Pryor, one of the senior players, you know, Metro Johnson got so quick, and you know, there was just a bit of a, you know, bit of fear there, or you know, bit of negativity there that wasn't there at the start of the tour. And once that kind of creeps into your dressing room and you start having a couple of bad performances, that momentum shifts. And you know, the Australians, when they get momentum, they really roll with it. And then when they've got their fans behind them as well and their media, it's just a really, really hard place to play cricket. And that certainly was a hard tour. And And like I said, we were just getting wiped every game. And, you know, a lot of the senior players were coming towards the end of their careers. You know, Graham Swan, you know, his elbow was gone. And Matt Pryor, he was struggling with injuries. And Kevin Peterson himself kept getting injured. So they're all coming towards the end of their kind of reign. And Alistair Cook at the time had only just started his captaincy. So he had quite a tough gig trying to take on these, you know, older senior players who had a bit of a whinge at times when things weren't going their way. And yeah, it just came to a sour end, unfortunately. And like I said, we lost at Perth. And I think Graham Swan going home after three test matches didn't set a great tone, even though I love Swan into bits. I think he should have stayed on tour just for the morale of the rest of the side, because it was a kind of horrible last 3 weeks. I didn't want to be there. It was just I didn't play, but you know, they brought in some of the the squad players like Boyd Rankins and Scott Borthwicks and these guys, and Gary Balance played and these guys, but they were a bit of a hiding to nothing because, you know, no one really wanted to play because we were already 4-0 down at Sydney. It was like, well, just chucking the young guys to have a game, really. It was a strange feeling, and it's just sad that everyone, you know, not everyone, but people fell out over it when generally they got on so well for such a long period of time. And obviously we've shared some good memories together. And I think everyone's now has kind of put it to bed. I think when KP sees Cookie and Swanee, they kind of like, you know, they've forgotten about it now, and you know, they've moved on finally, which is good. It's like you said, overall they've had some great times together, and they've won a lot of games of cricket for England and over a long period of time. So it's just sad that one tour can kind of make you fall out over certain things. But yeah, I'm sure they're over it now, hopefully.
Yeah. From your own perspective, obviously your career, played 12 tests, took 50 wickets, at a really good average. A lot of them away from home as well. What do you ever look back on your own career and think, what would have happened if I'd played 50 tests or 60 tests?
I mean, certainly as a youngster, that was my goal. I mean, Rob Marsh was coach of the academy, and he was like, you know, if you can keep fairly fit, he reckons, he said, I reckon you play 50 tests. He said, you're not going to play 100 tests because your body isn't going to hold up. Which I, you know, I wish I could kind of see with it. I was always had problems, always had injuries, there's always something. But yeah, I think it's just the way it is. I always believed that once I'd kind of played for England, even in one day cricket, I kind of knew I was good enough. But certainly when my body was fit and ready to go, when my body was a bit beaten down and I was running off painkillers every day of the week, which was most of my career, but you know, sometimes it was like I'm literally hanging on by a thread and playing. It was hard work, and I wasn't doing myself justice at times, but that's, you know, that's sport for you. You can't always be at your best. You're rarely, you know, as a bowler, you've always got some sort of injury. It is what it is. I just feel very lucky to, you know, knowing how many, I can't explain to people how many injuries I've had. Like, people would never believe me if I said, I think I've had 150 odd, maybe 200 MRI scans. I was literally lived in hospital. It was constant. And for the last 10 years of my career, I was on painkillers every day. It was like, it wasn't a glamorous lifestyle. I met my back operation in 2011-12. I wanted to come back so badly, to the point where I was getting up at 7 in the morning, popping painkillers, getting in a hot bath to stretch. Like, I was doing whatever I could to get through a game or to try and get back on another tour. Like, it was hard work, but it was all worth it. But you know, I'm not like a Stuart Broad or Jimmy Anson. My body just didn't allow me to just keep going, unfortunately. So I think if my body was better to me, and maybe if I didn't have a couple of injuries that I did quite so early in my career, things might have been different. But and you know, and you've been picked at different times in your career, but you know, I definitely don't have any regrets. So overall, like I said, knowing the injuries I've had, I've been very lucky to play as long as I did and have a 16-year career, I think I did at the end of the day. So it was hard at times, but at the same time, I loved it, and I'm very grateful to have had the experiences that I had. And I would have loved to have played 50 tests and taken 200. It just wasn't to be. And you know, there's a lot of guys in the same boat. You know, Simon Jones is another one. Like, if he'd had a bit more luck, you know, if he hadn't died for that ball, like things like that, his career might be very different. But it isn't. You just have to suck it up. And at the end of the day, I think you just have to appreciate the times that you had and say, look, I still achieved what I did. So, just try and remember the good things rather than the negative things, really.
You said near the top of the show that there was no ambition to go back and play any club cricket, so kind of missing cricket is probably not there. You've kind of transformed yourself into a bodybuilder now? Is what you're going for?
No, I train. I'm certainly not a bodybuilder. I don't want to be strutting around in a thong or anything like that.
No, I just
yeah, it's tan. I think playing cricket, you kind of. You know, I was a very skinny kid. My nickname is Twiggy. I was really, really skinny. I was always the tall kid. I was 6'5", 6'6" at school. I was ducking under the doors, and I always was really big, but very, very skinny. And I always wanted to get a bit bigger. And then, like, with cricket, even though I was quite big for a cricketer, but you know, naturally you had to be quite lean, and you know, you're doing a lot of running and a lot of cardio. So you're never going to be like a huge, hugely built person.
Say that to Rakeem Cornwall.
he's a big lad, to be fair. But when I retired, it's just like, I've been training a certain way for so long, you know, rowing, running, you know, did some weights during cricket, but it was just a completely different way of training. And since I retired, I've kind of got a bit of a passion for lifting weights and training in a different way. It's more just like, for a lot of it's for mental kind of health reasons. I always love working out, and now I can work out the way I want to work out. I just do the things that I know my body can do, and the things that I enjoy. So I train a bit, you know, bodybuilder type style training. I don't have any ambition to be a bodybuilder. I just enjoy, you know, the challenge of getting stronger and lifting weights. But like I said, it's just like a daily routine. My missus loves training. It's part of our kind of daily routine, really. But yeah, a lot of it is just for, you know, mental health, and that's something I enjoy doing. It's like a hobby, and like I said, I don't hate cricket. I love playing cricket. I just don't really like watching cricket. I'm not a massive cricket watcher. I'll always watch the highlights of England playing, and I know what's going on, but I'm not one to sit there for 5 or 6 hours and just watch cricket unless there's a really big occasion on, or you know, or if there's a really good 2020 game on, I watch that. But yeah, I just preferred playing it to watching it. And I think there's a lot of guys like that. It's very different when you're playing it to when you're watching it.
Yeah. Just more or less to wrap up, if we go back to your very first England game, you were on a hat-trick ball, I think, to be the first England debutant to take a hat-trick. Can you talk us through what happened with the hat-trick ball?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was a freak incident. Yeah, I actually played, I think, the week before, 2 weeks before, I was playing for Hampshire, and I got at Trent Bridge, and I got a hat-trick in the Championship. I got picked for the one-day squad, got called up as like a replacement, because I think Kabir Ali had a bit of a niggle or something. Then first game was at Trent Bridge against Bangladesh. We batted first and got, I think we got 350, and Paul Collingwood got some runs, maybe, or Strauss got some runs, and then... my hat-trick ball, basically. I ran into bowl, and Mohammad Ashraful at the time, I think it was their best player. He's gone to like play it down. It's bounced on the floor, bounced up kind of over his head, and it's boshed the stumps to like celebrate. Oh, I've got a hat-trick. And then looked down and the bails didn't move. And looked on the big screen and couldn't behave. The ball basically landed flush on the bails, and they didn't come off. So I didn't get a hat-trick. I think I got 4-4 in the game. But unfortunately didn't get an England hat-trick, because that would have been quite a nice thing to have under the belt, but especially in your first game. But one of those things just wasn't to be. I've never really thought about it. But when people show me that video or send it to me on Twitter or Instagram, it's quite funny to watch it. And that is pretty unlucky. It's probably one of those what happened next kind of moments, isn't it?
Chris, thank you ever so much for joining us on the show. You've been a fantastic guest. Thanks ever so much for sharing all you have.
No problem.
Cheers, Chris. Yeah,
it's been good fun. Thanks for having me, guys.
You're very welcome.
The Cricket Podcast.
I think it should never be permitted to happen again.
That is very good.